The second case for oral argument this morning is Jerry Cedar, appellant, versus Bruce Johnson, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Robert Christensen, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Thomas Cogley, an attorney from Aberdeen. Mr. Christensen, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. Good morning, everybody. Tom, all the way from Aberdeen. This is an alienation of affection case. Alienation of affection is a controversial piece of legislation across the country. Only seven or eight states still have it. Many of the alienation of affection statutes have been judicially abolished or legislatively abolished, but it's the law in South Dakota. That's the law that we're dealing with today. This case was a fairly typical alienation of affection case. A couple gets married. They've been married for about 15 years. My client felt that his wife's boss at a bar in Frederick was had a design on his wife, attempted to steal away the affection of her. We filed a lawsuit. It was tried in Aberdeen, South Dakota before Circuit Judge Summers. We put our case in and we rested. And at that time, the defendant made an oral motion to dismiss the case on two grounds. One, we didn't meet our liability burden, and two, we didn't meet our damage burden. Judge Summers denied the motion on liability, said we had met our burden there, at least to send it to the jury. But he granted the motion on damages. And his thinking was is that in our case in chief, the plaintiff did not specifically to testify to a monetary damage, which is true, he did not. So Judge Summers' his rationale was, well, how does the jury know to grant any money in this case when you gave the court, the jury, no guidance? So that's where we are here today. And actually, what the plaintiff here, the appellant here, is we're really seeking the court's guidance on that, because it's never that's never been talked about in South Dakota. And I will, if I can, I just will read you what the law that the Supreme Court has decided on damages in alienation of affection cases. It's the Morey v. Keller case, decided in 1957. It states as follows. The plaintiff in an action for alienation of affections may recover for all direct and proximate losses occasioned by the tort, including loss of love and consortium, and he or she may recover for any physical pain, mental agony, lacerated feelings, wounded sensibilities, humiliation, blow to honor, hurt to family life, suspicion cast on offspring. And they really cited the Amger, 27 Amger, husband and wife section on that. The court continued, and this is really what we're trying to emphasize. The court continued stating, the courts recognize the impossibility of formulating a definite rule whereby the loss of affection or consortium in money can be determined, and the jury must be allowed wide latitude. So we did not put a value on suspicion cast on offspring or mental agony. I don't know how you do that.
Was that a strategic call initially as the trial unfolded? How are you going to make your ultimate request to the jury should the matter have proceeded that far?
Well, in a prior summary judgment hearing before another circuit court judge, I stated that we're going to put attorney's fees in as monetary damages. The circuit court judge says, no, I'm not going to allow you to do that. In all the cases I've done, what we've done is we've counted on the jury liking our client, meeting our duties under the code, and then in oral or final argument, we make that argument. Really no different than in a personal injury case when, I've got a soft tissue injury, and it's very painful. Well, you go to a chiropractor and have a $200 bill, but many times a jury will award much more than that. So then what I did too is relied on a couple states that have addressed this issue more than this court has, North Carolina and Mississippi. And the cases are there, but they emphasize that you don't have to put in a pecuniary loss.
So under your theory, Mr. Christensen, you wouldn't have to put that in not only in your case in chief, but you'd never have to even suggest it in your argument if you didn't want to. You could, for instance, just get up to the jury at the end and say, you know, here's your verdict form, here's the line for loss consortium, we trust you to do what's right.
That's correct. Now, I wouldn't do that.
No, but I mean, is the quarrel that you have with what the circuit court did here based upon a technical view in your mind that there has to be this reduction to a sum certain in order to have a submissible case? Is that the disagreement that you have with Judge Summers' analysis?
That's correct. Okay. His analysis was that I understand that there was suffering, but he looked at the word, he wanted to know what the extent of the suffering was. Our position.
Well, I know that you can get an expert to testify on monetary damages for just about any subject matter under the sun, but in all the years I've been in the legal profession, I've never heard of an expert that would come in and testify what the value of the remainder of the marriage was.
That's correct. And usually what the plaintiffs will say, well, my marriage, I lost because of the acts of the defendant. My marriage is priceless. I mean, a plaintiff comes in and says, yeah, the value of my marriage was $5,000. Well, they're thinking, whoa, that's not, you didn't think that much of your marriage. And Judge Summers suggested, I think he's tongue-in-cheek, he said, well, you should ask for $1 million. Well, these two people lived in Frederick. I think the population of the town is 350 people. I think 11% of the population lived under the poverty line. The people up there are not going to award $1 million. And to place us in that position that we have to do that, it puts us in a really tight spot.
So both sides submitted instructions in this case saying that plaintiff has the burden to prove nature and extent of damages. You agree
yes.
with that?
Yes.
That's your burden?
Yes.
And so tell me, what does that require you to put on in the way of evidence to prove nature and extent of damages in this type of a case?
Well, first of all, the Morey case, it says one of the damages you can recover for is hurt to family. The plaintiff in this case testified that the defendant destroyed his family life. And what he meant by that, he said he lost his marriage, he lost his wife, and also they had a child that was now growing up in two families. He didn't want that. He also testified that he lost the consortium of his wife. They used to do things together, they don't do it anymore. They had an active sex life, they didn't have that anymore. They didn't say, I love you, before they went to bed. He didn't have that. And by the way, he was crying when he said this. And that's something that, of course, this court doesn't see. But that had a big impact on the jury.
So if your instruction, do you meet your obligation, or do you set about to meet your obligation to prove damage with reasonable certainty? If the court, at least in terms of the principles that are in play, if the court instructs this way, with these three elements, one, you have to, members of the jury, find damages with reasonable certainty. Two, mathematical precision is not required. Three, it cannot be the product of speculation. Is that a correct instruction of the law?
That's a correct interpretation of the law, yes. Here's our position, Judge. Everything in our society is owned by somebody. We put a value on everything. If you wreck your car and the guy at the body shop says there's $5,000 in damages, that's easy to put together. If someone intentionally harms your crop, you can put a value on that. Go to the elevator, there's 10 bushels, so much a bushel. What we're trying to do here is put a value on a relationship. And that's why this is an alienation of affection case is different from those cases. We're trying to put a value on a relationship and the loss of that relationship. Now, if the court decides, well, you have to, plaintiffs have to say, well, the lacerated feelings, that was $5,000, and the emotional stress, that's $10,000. I mean, we can certainly do that because we're really looking for guidance. Our position is you don't have to do that. We don't want you to do that. We want you to send this case back and let us try it again.
So do you want to try just damages if the matter is reversed?
Well, I don't know if we could do that because we just put our case in chief. So I would think the whole trial would have to start from new. My understanding, the standard you review this on is de novo. So based on what you have and based on what the Morey case says, I think you can just reverse the trial court and send it back, and we'd be happy with that.
So the defendant never even put on his case?
Excuse me, Judge?
In the trial that you had, the proceeding, the defendant never even had an opportunity to put on their case. It was tossed out after you rested?
Yes.
Okay, so you'd start over, basically?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So all the damages you requested in the case at trial were non-economic in nature?
Right.
Can you, it may not be relevant to this case, but can you alienation of affection case asked for economic damages? Is that encompassed within the...
The two cases I cited from Mississippi and North Carolina, you can ask for pecuniary damages, loss of money there, and you can also ask for these emotional damages and loss of consortium, which is separate. The trouble with that is in the Southern cases, if you lose your house and you had two incomes, you can testify to that because that would be a family loss of income that helped buy the house. If you lose that, you can testify to that. They said that you can ask for a loss of insurance benefits, things like that. But the problem with that is if the family doesn't have insurance, can't afford to see a doctor. If the wife or husband isn't working, it's very hard to establish that type of loss. So this is simply, I lost my family. So what's the value of that loss? And my position is, as well as those two other cases I've cited, the jury decides that. The jury puts the value on that. And that's all we're asking to be allowed to do.
But you're not saying, and I think I understand your position, you're not saying that economic damages are a requirement or a predicate. Non-economic damages in and of themselves could be sufficient to submit to the jury if it's properly instructed.
That's correct. That's exactly right. So, unless there's other questions, that's all I have right now.
Well, as I said in the previous hour, nobody's ever criticized for quitting early. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Cogley, you have 20 minutes, sir.
It's a long walk from that table to this podium. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Tom Cogley. I'm privileged to represent the defendant in this case, Mr. Bruce Johnson. I'm hoping to talk about three issues, but I'll start with the damage issue. It's my opinion that the trial court was correct when it granted my motion for judgment as a matter of law as to damages. And the reason is because Mr. Cedar failed to provide the jury with sufficient evidence that would allow it to conclude with reasonable certainty any level of damages.
Well, how is he supposed to do that? I guess you got tag teamed. I've never heard of an expert witness in that area. obviously, he's going to be cross-examined as how he felt his personal damages are worth. How does he prove that?
Sure, Your Honor, that's a great question, and I think it has to be answered in conjunction with a review of the court's case law. And I'm thinking of the Hy-Vee Foods case when you talked about this reasonable certainty standard requires there to be proof of some rational basis for measuring loss. It can't just be based on speculation. And I think if we look at the cases that were cited by Mr. Christensen in his brief and the facts in those cases and compare them with this case, I think you're going to see that my position is that Mr. Cedar left this jury with nothing but speculation, passion, and prejudice from which to conclude.
What if the plaintiff's case would have included testimony from Mr. Cedar that was identical to everything that we have in the record, but with the exception of the additional question and answer exchange in which he testified, and I place my value at $200,000. Different result?
Potentially, Your Honor. It would have put him in a better position because at least then there would be some basis for which the jury to measure damages.
But so yes or no? Different result? Yes, no, or you don't know?
I think that the answer would be yes, but I think that the jury, based on what the evidence that was presented, this jury still would not have really any ability. What I'm saying, Judge, is that I think he maybe could have gotten past the motion for judgment as a matter of law and gotten it to the jury, but we'd be back here with me arguing that there wasn't sufficient evidence for the jury to reach that conclusion of $200,000.
The standard review is roughly the same, but I understand your argument. Let me pose it this way, then. Isn't at the heart of your case, isn't there a fundamental disagreement, perhaps, you tell me if I'm right or wrong, with the idea that a plaintiff in an alienation of affections case can submit to the jury a claim of entirely non-economic damages that are not tethered or connected to any damage model, any invoice, any bill, anything like that? Isn't that at the heart of your argument?
Are you asking me if I agree with that statement?
Yes.
I think a plaintiff could. I think that the jury instructions in this case and the jury instructions for this cause of action actually allow for things like loss of income, loss of services, the value of those.
Economic damages. My question is, though, do you have a fundamental disagreement with the idea, right or wrong, and this is not a rule of this court yet, but do you have a fundamental disagreement with the view and the argument that a plaintiff could submit a damage claim that is entirely comprised of non-economic damages?
I don't think that would be appropriate in these types of cases.
So you have a fundamental disagreement with that. You don't think that ought to be the law?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. And I think that's what the trial court was getting at when it talked about the extent of damages. And here's an example. You know, if we have a car accident and the plaintiff breaks his leg, the plaintiff can come in and he can talk about it was the defendant's fault, the defendant was liable for the accident. He can talk about the pain and suffering that he suffered as a result of the accident. He can talk about his leg being in a cast for 6 weeks. He can talk about loss of work. He can talk about when he gets back to work, the pain being too great and he couldn't do the work the way that he did before. He ended up taking a different job for less money. That caused him heartache and depression and counseling, and he showed all of these things. The jury from there, and we allow them to do this, and they should be allowed to do this, the jury then can take that evidence and it can demonstrate, at least plausibly, depending on the reward or the award, a rational basis to measure damages.
Of course, if we accept your argument, we'll have to revise our ruling from Morey versus Keller, in which we held that a plaintiff can recover for all, emphasis, direct and proximate losses occasioned by the tort, including a host of non-economic damages. We'll have to revise that holding to say, as long as they prove a predicate claim of economic damages.
I think you could. I don't think you have to. I think if you look at the evidence that was presented in this case, the only testimony that was provided about any damages was Mr. Cedar's claim that this was emotional for him and his child. That's not sufficient. The jury is going to be left to just guess.
He testified that he loved his wife. He testified that he wanted to be married to her, that he had, in the words of Morey versus Keller, I guess, lacerated feelings. I don't know if that's a fair inference. He didn't say that, but wounded sensibilities. You don't think that any of those are implicated by his testimony?
I think they all fall under the statement that I just made, which is this is emotional, which is no different than any other relationship that ends. And if we had submitted this case to the jury, whether Mr. Christensen asked for $5,000 or $500,000, we would not have any reasonable certainty how the jury came to that conclusion. If we look at the cases that he cited, the North Carolina and the Mississippi or the Missouri cases that he cited, there's inability to sleep, there's weight gain, there's depression, there's the loss of income from the spouse, there's the mental anguish, there's other witnesses testifying about the mental anguish that the plaintiff suffered. There's testimony about the loss of standing in the community. In one particular case, I think it was the Hunt case, they must have been a renowned couple in the community. There's none of that here. There's just Mr. Cedar saying, and let's be clear, I'm not belittling what he experienced in the sense that his marriage ended. I would disagree with why it ended, and we'll talk about that, I guess, in a moment.
Okay, I understand your argument.
I'm not belittling that. I'm just saying that what he provided to the jury, the only way they're going to reach a verdict is by speculating or by passion and prejudice. And that's not what's allowed. And that's what the trial court was getting at when it talked about its discussion with Mr. Christensen in ruling on this motion. It's actually probably closer to sort of go back to the conversation we were just having, Justice Salter, about it's probably closer to a negligent infliction of emotional distress type of case. But the reality is that there was no way that this jury was going to, based on the evidence that was submitted by Mr. Cedar, be able to establish with a reasonable degree of certainty any rational basis by which to measure damages.
Well, why would that differ? If he would have said, and I lost sleep for 2 weeks straight, how is a jury going to be any more equipped to place an economic value on that than they are for hurt feelings? How? There's no formula for that. As the Chief Justice indicated, there's no expert testimony that we're confronted with in this case. I understand your argument, but let's run it out to its logical end. How does that change anything?
I think it goes to the extent, and the jury's going to be able to put a timeline on it, for instance, in terms of if you couldn't sleep for 3 months or if you did counseling for 6 months, the jury's going to be able to have some type of ability to measure damages, just like with that broken leg and the pain and suffering and how long were you unable to go do an activity that you enjoyed doing. All we have here, and I understand the segments that you parsed out for us, Justice, but all we have here is a guy who's basically saying that this affected him negatively. And that's not enough. And that's why the trial court determined that the motion for judgment as a matter of law should be granted.
What about the issue that you've raised about, I think you're calling for an abrogation of a statute that is fairly rare, to say the least, in South Dakota, where the Supreme Court strikes out a statute as against public policy. We've faced the issue before. We've ruled on it. What's different this time?
I think that the last time that you directly addressed this case, I think it was an opinion authored by yourself, Chief Justice, and I would say that what has changed is not necessarily this court's precedent, but society has changed. And I've been surprised anecdotally as people have learned that I was coming here to argue this. I've been surprised at how many people, particularly women, were getting after me to strenuously convince you folks to abrogate this law. I understand
Well, but you know what happened after Veeder? Veeder, we addressed an invitation to the legislature. There are very few states that have this anymore. Legislature, you might want to take a look at this. They did, but you know what they did? Instead of abrogating it by repealing it, they made it apply to both men and women. They strengthened the law. So I don't know how you get a stronger message from the legislature than that after Veeder.
Yes, Your Honor. What I would say in response to that is that, again, we're now looking at 20 years down the road, and maybe it is a better avenue to go through the legislature, but this court can do it too. Five states have judicially abolished it. As you noted in your opinion in Veter, four of them did it under the common law cause of action. Only one of them did it under the statute, but it has happened.
Counsel, did you raise this below?
I'm sorry?
Did you raise this issue before the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor.
At what point did you raise it at the trial court level?
I believe it was done as a summary judgment motion prior to trial, Your Honor.
Okay, so there were two summary judgment motions. There's your first motion. It's not raised in that motion, correct?
Correct, sir.
That was ruled on and denied.
Correct.
There's a second motion filed a week before trial. Where is that ruled on in the record? Where would I find that?
It had been ruled on, at least orally. I don't know if it was ever reduced to writing as we stand here, Your Honor, but the trial court did deny the motion.
But is there somewhere in the transcript that would show that?
I can't recall as I stand here, Your Honor.
And then my next question is, you cross-appealed from the trial court's denial of your judgment as a matter of law and liability. Did you cross-appeal from either summary judgment motion?
I believe I filed a notice of review on the issue of public policy, Your Honor. Is that what you're asking?
That's what I'm asking.
Okay. Yes, I believe I did that. And if I could just talk about the judgment as a matter of law on the liability question, because I do think that's a decision that Judge Summers got incorrect. And I think what he did was he stated to me that the reason he wasn't going to allow it was because that Cedar and Jerry had testified that his wife had affection for him. I think that's a narrow view of what the case law reads, and I think it's inconsistent with what the case law reads based on this court's precedent. I think what Jerry has to show is that Bruce was aware that there was affection and that he nonetheless acted with the intent to alienate that affection. And I think that's what the court was getting at in the State Farm decision in 2007. And I realize that three of your honors weren't on the court, but Chief Justice, you were, and Justice Center, you were, and you joined in that decision. And they looked at sort of the case law going back, and what they recognized was that some of the earlier cases might have pronounced a more relaxed general intent view of this cause of action. But it then went through Pancratz and through Veter, and noted that they properly defined this as more of a specific intent type of cause of action. And I'm not, Mr. Christensen indicated in his brief that I'm somehow urging you to add an element to this cause of action. I'm not. That the element about proving that the defendant acted with the specific intent to alienate the affections of Leslie from Jerry is already in there. I'm just asking that if the phrase specific intent be given the definition that's typically given to it.
And difficult to apply, though, at the close of the plaintiff's case where, under the standard for judgment as a matter of law, the trial court has to construe and make all reasonable inferences in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, the plaintiff here. So difficult to do at that stage. Wouldn't you agree?
I think that's the time to do it, Your Honor. I think that Jerry had to, even if we look at the evidence.
But wouldn't it necessarily contemplate some weighing of evidence by the trial court at that point? It's good enough, it's not good enough, I'm weighing the evidence. I mean, it might be that if there's a complete dearth and absence of that evidence, perhaps, but I understand your argument to be it just maybe wasn't sufficient enough, but maybe I'm misconstruing your argument.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, because I am saying that there was no evidence. And if we look at it...
Not even inferentially?
No, Your Honor, and here's why. If Bruce Johnson testified, he was called by Mr. Christensen as part of their case in chief, and he testified that in his mind, from his interactions with Leslie, the marriage was over. That she was only staying with Jerry because they had this child together, and as soon as the child turned 18, she was going to divorce him. Leslie testified to that herself. She also testified that she never indicated to Bruce that she had any affection for her husband. And the reason that's important, Your Honors, is because in order to prove specific intent, at least in the criminal context, there has to be some intent in addition to the act, right? So Bruce would have had to have subjectively known or desired a result. In this case, he would have had to have subjectively known or desired to alienate her affections from Jerry.
It's unlikely he'd admit that during his testimony, wouldn't you agree?
I absolutely would agree, but here's what I would say in response to that. in the criminal context, prosecutors prove specific intent crimes all the time. And they do that by using the underlying circumstances and facts surrounding that particular incident. And plaintiffs in this case can do the same thing, right? And if Jerry would put, had put on some evidence that, well, let's talk about what he put on. He talked about photographs. He talked about birthday cards. He talked about them. He claimed that him and his wife said, I love you, every night before they went to bed. He claimed that they took walks. But where in those things is there evidence that Bruce was made aware of them? In other words, where's the evidence that Bruce saw them together dancing at the town hall? Where's the evidence that Leslie was torn over this decision? None of that stuff is there. And it can be shown. It's shown all the time in criminal in the criminal context. It's not as though any defendant can just stand up and say, well, I didn't know that she had any affections and therefore I can't be liable.
I thought there was some testimony from Ms. Cedar that Mr. Johnson had, what was the expression, worked his magic, been persuasive, something like that.
I think what you're referring to, Justice, is Jerry's testimony about what he claimed Leslie said to him.
So, but it was in evidence?
Yes, sir. Okay. But Leslie, even if that were true, that doesn't support a finding that Leslie made Bruce aware of her affection for her husband.
I don't want to quarrel with you, but wouldn't that create an inference that if Bruce was trying to win her affection, that he did that as part of a plan to do that?
I'm pausing because I can't think of any reason why it would, Your Honor. It doesn't demonstrate anything other than what Jerry claims Leslie had said, and even if we take it as true, it still doesn't communicate anything between, or it still doesn't communicate any knowledge of that Bruce may have had that this marriage was still a happy marriage.
Counsel, I'd like to turn your attention back to this question of abrogation of the tort. On what grounds, presuming that it's preserved, which you have told us it is, from your filing of the motion and the presentation of the question to the trial court, on what grounds should this court, in light of the legislature's response after Veeder, now abrogate this tort?
One of the grounds, Your Honor, would be just the difficulty. It has to do with the discussion we had for the first 10 minutes or so, and that's the difficulty of ascertaining damages.
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's so difficult in these cases for a jury to actually, and I think the Idaho Supreme Court, when it abolished this tort, it said that these verdicts are so tainted by passion and prejudice that we just can't allow them to happen. The other reason, one other reason to do it is that it doesn't do what it purports to do. It doesn't protect marriage and families. The Law Review article that I cited from 2003 debunks that myth.
So the court would tell the legislature that they're wrong about determining what the law of the state should be? Because it's not a good idea and doesn't do what they think it should do?
I think that the court can say to the legislature, you haven't taken action on this, and it's so clearly against the public policy of this state, and it's so repugnant to the policy of this state because of the inception of how it came to be and its view of spouses as property, that we're going to take action where you're not.
But in the South Dakota Code, right in Volume 1, it says the public policy of this state is set by the legislature in its legislation. So how do we trump that short of declaring the law unconstitutional, which you have not asked us to do?
That's correct, Your Honor, I haven't. I'm simply asking you to take action where the legislature hasn't and declare that this statute is unconstitutional for the reasons that I've outlined for you. If there's nothing else, then I will sit down. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, Mr. Coghlan. Mr. Christensen, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
I'll address four issues, then I'll sit down. As for the speculation of damages, I'm just going to read to the court for guidance what the North Carolina court stated in the Scott v. Kinkler case. the court went on to say that defendant's third argument is that the trial court erred by not allowing his motion to set aside the award of damages because the plaintiff failed to show he suffered any pecuniary loss since his income increased after his divorce. Defendant is mistaken in his belief that compensatory damages must be based on pecuniary loss. In determining compensatory damages, the jury may also consider the loss of consortium, humiliation, shame, mental anguish, loss of sexual relations, and the disgrace the torturous acts of defendant have brought. So that's for guidance. And they go on to state, citing the Huttmeyer case, in addition to plaintiff's evidence showing a loss of income, life insurance, and pension resulting from the actions of defendant, there was also plenary evidence that plaintiff likewise suffered loss of consortium, mental anguish, humiliation, and injury to health. So in an alienation of affection case, it is different than a car accident. They're just different. You're trying to put a value on a relationship. It's difficult to do. And I agree with the Chief Justice. How do you find an expert to come along and help you with that? So the only guidance is the testimony of the plaintiff and friends and family members. The second is for asking the court to abrogate this tort. The Veeder case, I think you made it very clear that it's the public policy of the state. And I don't think this court wants to judicially abrogate the case, the statute. But if there was some constitutional issue, maybe you'd consider it. But there's no constitutional issue before the court here. And the statute is gender neutral. It doesn't favor husbands or wives. It's gender neutral. So a lot of those things have been corrected. The third issue is having the defendant aware that there is affection between the husband and wife. That just wouldn't work. Every defendant in the state of South Dakota would simply say, I wasn't aware that there is any affection, case over. It just doesn't make any sense to apply that. And really, it would be adding another hurdle for the plaintiff to climb if you ever adapted that. Finally, as for affection between the plaintiff and defendant in this case, whether or not there was affection in the case really is a question of fact for the jury to decide. The wife, Leslie, in the case testified that, I've always loved JC, which is my client. I've always loved JC, don't get me wrong. So she testified that she always loved him. So the jury could infer that there was affection. And in the jury room, they can debate whether it's enough to sustain the case. But it has to go to the jury in the issue of affection. So, and in the alienation of affection case too, the defendant can create this specific intent to alienate at any time during the affair. It can come at any time. It doesn't have to come in the beginning. It can come any time. So whether or not that came about is really another question of fact for the jury and the issue of affection. So anyway, what we'd like the court to do is you know, really help us all out on this, because we really don't know. And I think what I advocate is the court just to say that if you give testimony that there was a loss of affection, a loss of the marriage, emotional distress, all those things set out in Maury, then you ought to just let it go to the jury and keep it the way it is, and not state that you have to put some financial number on humiliation. And if you do, we'd appreciate the guidance. So unless there's any more questions, I'm finished. So
okay. Thank you, Mr. Christensen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. The court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.